Hey, folks, today's episode is brought to you by our favorite sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. SunsetLakeCBD.com, they have those new melatonin elderberry gummies to help you sleep. They also have sour gummies. They have tinctures. They have pre-rolls. They have kief. They have flour. They have fudge, they have coffee, all with CBD, and they use the best agricultural practices, integrated pest management, no use of pesticides, organic fertilizer. They use regenerative farming practices with the help of University of Vermont. They have great business practices. They are movement partners. They raised most recently, I think it was $4,000 for the Innocence Project. We've done programs with them. They've raised $10,000 for Give Directly. They've sent money to strike funds and to soup kitchens. They're just great folks, and they have a great product. And the coupon code is LEFTISBEST, gets you 20% off all of their CBD products. For me, the Arnica and CBD Salve, for muscle aches, but for me, it's been great on my eczema. I know that's not what it's there for, but I use it and it's great. Check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Support them. Support the show. Left is best. 20% off. And now for that very show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 27th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton, or Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo, will be joining us. Also on the program today, the police in Uvalde, Texas story keeps changing as it becomes clear that the good guys with a gun just didn't want to get shot. Also on the program, White House to offer a new package of gun control measures that they deludedly think have a shot in passing. Meanwhile, Republicans blocked the domestic terror bill in the wake of the Buffalo shooting, as an investigation shows at least six people had advance warning of that shooting, including one former FBI agent. New York Court of Appeals finds that the New York Attorney General can question Trump under oath, and the January 6th Commission hears testimony that former chief of staff to Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, was literally burning documents in the White House. Rumblings, speaking of the White House, of $10,000 in student debt forgiveness, means tested at $150,000 per yearly income. Biden administration looking to crush that famous climate lawsuit brought by young people back in 2015. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Casual Friday. Joining me in our casual attire, of course, is Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I've got to say, watching the video and reading the stories about what took place in Texas, I mean, it is it is a horror show for any, I think, rational or empathetic human being. I don't know if it's particularly uniquely horrific with when you're talking about kids, when you have a kid that age or you have any type of kid. I can tell you that, like, after I had a child, you know, some commercials would choke me up. The stories coming from these parents is just horrific. I mean, just incredibly heartbreaking. The and we're going to talk about this with Heather, but you know, the stories of the cops not doing anything, but also just sort of like from a structural standpoint, 40% of this town in Texas' budget is dedicated to this police force, and you know, they did nothing. It appears to really they were not willing to risk anything in trying to stop this guy.
Despite having the training, the requisite training for this exact situation, New York Times reporting like 16 hours ago that they've obtained some documentation that cops in Uvalde had done preparations for a school shooter situation, and they still were seemingly wildly inadequate in their response, if not negligent.
And I vacillate, and again, we'll talk more with Heather about this. I vacillate going back and forth between, you know, sort of obviously there should be anger at the police, but there also should be sort of like a broader lesson, which is, you know, the whole notion of like good guys with guns, like, you know, they don't want to get shot either, because this guy's holding multiple, you know, not quite military grade. The homosexuals don't need to email in, but enough that the you know, these weapons intimidate cops, and so, you know, it is that part of the lesson. Like, you know, like there should be anger at the police. There should be anger that these type of resources are dedicated to the police, despite the fact that there's obvious limitations in what they can do. And you know, I don't know if they had half that budget and that other half of that budget went into all sorts of better social services, maybe that doesn't happen. Who knows? But, certainly if you have that budget and put the rest into social services, the town itself would be just in a better, place. But it also just shows that, like, the whole theory that you can inhibit these type of shootings without having to get rid of the weapon, which is, you know, turns out to be the material issue, right? That person goes in there with a gun. Those cops aren't out there waiting for an hour. If that guy goes in there with, you know, even like a, I don't know, you know, a 22 or, you know, a handgun, you know, it's just unbelievable. But
yeah, well,
I don't know which one of these clips you want to play.
We should do one. I mean, that right, fits into what we're talking about.
Play clip number one.
Inside those classrooms.
But don't curse.
No, it's okay. We can just preface it really quickly then, before we get into it. Here, it's okay. Here is Wolf Blitzer on with Texas Lieutenant Chris Olivares, speaking about the Uvalde shooting, and Wolf Blitzer is basically asking him why, as reports indicate, it took at least an hour for cops to, quote, engage with the shooter in the school, even though there were conflicting reports, and it seems like a CYA situation where cops were telling the media that they had engaged with him previously. Now we're not sure.
You don't know how they're using words like engaged or contained. It's all lies.
Yeah, I mean, they make it as squishy as possible for that very reason. And this response from this Texas officer, or lieutenant, I should say, is enraging, frankly.
Or teachers that were inside those classrooms.
But don't current the best practices, Lieutenant, call for officers to disable a shooter as quickly as possible, regardless of how many officers are actually on site.
Correct. The active shooter situation, you want to stop the killing, you want to preserve life. But also, one thing that, of course, the American people need to understand is that officers are making entry into this building. They do not know where the gunman is. They are hearing gunshots. They are receiving gunshots. At that point, if they proceeded any further, not knowing where this suspect was at, they could have been shot. They could have been killed. And at that point, that gunman would have the opportunity to kill other people inside that school. So they were able to contain that gunman inside that classroom.
So when they say contained the gunman inside the classroom, what happened was, yeah, they did. That gunman stayed in that classroom, and he killed everybody in that classroom as they were watching Moana.
They use active voice and say they contained him. No, he went in and locked himself in that room.
Yeah, right. Oh, wow, we made sure that he didn't go elsewhere as he was on his murdering spree. You can keep going, but it's just like... They frame the language so favorable in their direction. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And, you know, there's been about a half a dozen times so far where the police story has evolved at different times. And to a certain extent, you can understand there's going to be a lot of misinformation at the beginning of these things. And there's a lot of confusion. But it's also quite clear that they were just trying to cover their asses because they realized at one point, like, we did nothing. We did nothing. I don't know what they assumed would happen, but they did nothing.
And to your point about that you were making earlier about the reasoning for them not wanting to follow protocol and actually attempt to stop the shooter, they've had training, according to the New York Times, in these kinds of situations, which they just did not follow because they were scared for their lives. Why were they scared for their lives? It was because of the weaponry that the shooter had. And, like, we're going to hear a lot of solutions proposed, but guarantee one of them is going to be, well, now the cops all have to have AR-15s. Like, we gotta match them, right? Because if they were outgunned and they were scared for their lives, even though it's their job, they're literally paid to be public servants. I understand it's scary. Of course they're fearful for their lives. That makes total sense. But at the same time, there needs to be a multi-pronged approach to this to fix things, which is, one, to ban these assault rifles outright and have a gun buyback program where it's lucrative for people to sell back their AR-15s or whatever they have to the government and ban future sales of them. And then, secondly, we need to look at what cops even do for our society, because this whole good guy with a gun thing, as you say, Sam, we have definitive proof here what actually went down, and they failed. They failed miserably. And you see these videos of the parents wailing outside in pain and in agony of this school as the cops are standing around outside. Like, this should be a moment of reckoning, but I have very little faith that that will be the case.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Heather Parton. But before we do, got a couple of words from our sponsors. Well, let's just take a break, and then we'll get up the shop, and then I'll do the sponsors. Hey, folks, a couple words from our sponsors today. If you are looking for a podcast to listen to, I have said many times before, these recent history podcasts are an excellent way to understand the context of different issues that come up today. You should check out Fiasco. It's a new Audible original podcast. It's a documentary style show that is hosted by Leon Neffock. He's the co-creator and original host of Slow Burn. If you like the classic seasons that Leon and his team made about Watergate and the Clinton impeachment, you're going to love Fiasco. Each season of Fiasco goes deep on a huge, important story from American history and brings it back to life through original interviews with key players and witnesses. This newest season of Fiasco is all about the AIDS crisis. It's an attempt to reexamine and reckon with the last time a deadly virus transformed American society. All the uncertainty, the fear, the failure of our political system, and particularly some Republicans, and frankly, Democrat in the mayor of New York, for that matter, the prejudice that was involved in it. Really fascinating stuff, and important to get these concepts as you know, for current day. You can listen to the new season of Fiasco exclusively on Audible. Just go to audible.com/fiascopod or text fiascopod to 500-500. Also, today's program is sponsored by Quip. Quip has become a mainstay in my house, really, now for, I don't know, like 4 years. If you use Quip, you will find that the quality of your smile is going to increase significantly. Why? Because it's a great toothbrush. In fact, all of Quip has, they're basically, in my estimation, a design company that has been focusing on dental hygiene, and they have everything that you need for a good smile and, frankly, to develop the habits that you need to protect your teeth and your gums, I guess. The Quip electric toothbrush uses timed vibrations. They have 30-second pulses to guide you through a dentist-recommended two-minute clean. It is loved by over 7 million mouths. That includes mine, both my children, my sisters now. You can even upgrade with a new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. Build your whole routine with an even more Quip, like the reusable floss pick. They have a reusable flosser that is an insanely great design. I don't know. I'm amazed by it. I'm a big flosser thing because I don't like to hold it around my hands. And their reusable flosser is amazing. They also have refillable mouthwash, so you don't need to use these big plastic jugs. And on top of that, Quip delivers brush heads, fresh floss, and other refills every month from just $5. No extra shipping costs. Check it out, folks. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. That is spelled getquip.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. All right. I want to welcome to the show Heather Parton. And of course, Emma will join me here. Can we? There we go. All right. Yeah. Heather, the proprietor of the blog Digby, Hullabaloo, also known as Digby, and also a writer at Salon.com. Heather, I feel like we've been here literally dozens of times before, and there's something, you know, uniquely horrific about elementary school kids and the stories that are coming out of Uvalde, Texas. I don't know. It's so demoralizing.
Well, you're so right. You know, when I think about the times that we've talked to each other over the years about this issue, and it's, you're right, it's been dozens, I'm sure, that we've had these conversations. And I think about the change that's come over me. And I mean, I'm, you know, pretty on in years now, so it's been a while and I've been watching this stuff. But I have to say that I don't think I've ever felt more demoralized about it than I do now. And it's been coming on slowly. I mean, I think I thought after Sandy Hook, right, which was, I think, the one that we thought would shock the conscience of the country, the collective conscience of the country into actually doing something about guns. I mean, it just seemed unfathomable that you could look at a situation like that and see a, you know, a young man, young teenage boy having access to a weapon of war to go in and kill little children seemed beyond the capacity even of the United States to excuse and to allow to continue. And I've written about this many times over the years because it was such an incredible story of power and influence by one lobbying group. I mean, this really was the NRA. After Sandy Hook, it was considered, I mean, I think most of us thought, and rightfully so, because people really were. There were Republicans were saying, hey, look, okay, you know, uncle, got to do something here. The board of the NRA said in meetings that people have recounted later, look, this is time. We've got to do so. We've got to move here. We've got to do something. And so they said, they scheduled a press conference in D.C. And Wayne LaPierre went down to the Washington Press, you know, whatever that organization is, to give this big speech where everyone expected that the NRA was going to say, okay, it's time for some compromise. Let's do this, that, or the other. Maybe background checks. I mean, they had a law that was ready to go on background checks at the time. And instead, he got up completely defiant and laid out the talking points that are still in place today. The problem isn't too many guns. It's not enough guns. The only thing that'll stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And that's when he opened the idea of arming teachers in classrooms, that we have to harden the schools, all these kinds of lines that we hear today. It shocked people when he did it. But it was a shot across the bow to all the Republicans, and that nothing, not even the killing of tiny children with AR-15s, was going to be enough for them to, you know, adopt anything but their most rigid stance. And it's been that way ever since. And that was when I first started to lose heart about all this and think, if that didn't do it, nothing will. And then there was that shooting in Las Vegas where a guy up in the Mandalay Bay Hotel shot out a window, and he shot a bunch of country music fans in Nevada. Now, that was shooting at the, you know, presumably many pro-gun people. I mean, Nevada's kind of a pro-gun state. It's a Western state. You know, there's lots of guns around. And these were people there for a country music concert. I think it's fair to assume that a good many of them were probably Republicans. And it was a massive shooting. Do you remember how many? I mean, it was hundreds that they were actually were wounded, and many, many were shot there. And I thought, well, maybe that'll change things, that, you know, these are their people, right? And this is some deranged guy shooting them with AR-15s from a hotel room window. And again, nothing happened. And, you know, the ritual that I'm sure you guys have been talking about, that we've all been talking about, you know, the thoughts and prayers, that we've got to do something. They have meetings in Washington, you know, the usual mental health and all the rest of it. And after that one, I think I really lost heart. And I think that was really kind of the end of my optimism that we were going to be able to do something. And I know that sounds terrible. I mean, it's like, how can we let this go on? But I honestly don't know what to do. And the reason is that it's not the NRA wielding checks anymore. The NRA is in distress. It's in crisis. It may not even survive. They have been through bankruptcy. Wayne LaPierre is under, you know, a huge cloud under scandal. And in fact, there's this huge lawsuit in New York brought by Letitia James against the NRA. I mean, they were just actually a couple months ago. She wanted to dissolve it. And she had, you know, made the assumption that she had the power to do that, and the judge ruled against her. But the suit remains against LaPierre and all the people at the very top who've essentially been embezzling money. So the NRA is no longer the juggernaut that it once was. It still has certain kind of social power and cachet among gun owners, but it's not really the kind of super powerhouse. But what we found is, I think, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yep.
The people are the NRA. The Republican voters are the NRA. Gun rights are their identity. It is now, it is social and political identity for these people. And the NRA, you have to give Wayne LaPierre credit for this. He's the guy who made this happen. I mean, he came in and did it, but it's no longer, who needs the NRA? In fact, the Kevin Cramer, the freshman South Dakota or North Dakota senator said yesterday, he's kind of one of those guys who blurts out the truth.
Right.
And New York Times asked him, what would happen if you voted for, some kind of sensible gun regulation? He said, oh, the people would vote me out of office. It's that simple. It's not about, principle or I believe in the Second Amendment or blah, blah, blah. It's just I'd get voted out of office. And he's probably right. So there we are.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, what? I just one comment really briefly. It's kind of analogous to the way that Trump has also kind of dominated in terms of if you voted to impeach me or if you were in any way skeptical of January 6th, like, that's the way that Republican voters have been disciplined to hold those Republicans accountable.
Yeah, for sure. And this is sort of the way that they work now, right? I mean, and it's not really coming from, nobody can order them around, right? It's like, that's been one of the big myths here. It's like, the NRA, rules with an iron fist, or Donald Trump can, has them all wrapped around his finger. Well, I mean, to some extent they do, but we look at the election results in these primaries and Donald Trump doesn't have them wrapped around his finger to the extent that he can tell them what to do. But he does have the Republican, officials wrapped around his finger, at least on a national scale. Some of the locals seem to still have a little bit of independence left, but not very many. And you're right, because what has happened, though, is that the voters on the Republican side, and I think, we have to admit this, it's the voters. Republican voters who are
irresponsible. This has been, this dynamic has been growing for as long as I've been doing this, and Digby, it was more or less the same time, or at the very least.
Yeah. For sure.
Because we first saw this, I mean, and the analogy I used to use, and it just became almost so obvious, it wasn't even worthwhile suggesting, was that Frankenstein created this monster, and now the monster's running loose through the town. Mm-hmm. And there's no, Frankenstein created it, but he can't necessarily control it. There's some things when Frankenstein's monster comes around and sees, his creator and sort of like, okay, and maybe doesn't go and pull out that guy's neck. But, we saw this. I think the first example of this was when Bush tried to do immigration reform.
Yep.
And Levin and Laura Ingraham and Hannity and Limbaugh and all of those pillars of the Republican Party. I don't say that facetiously. They have control over these people in a way that that the Republican politicians don't, because these people don't want to cede that control. And when Bush tried to do some form of immigration reform, I'm not giving him a plaudits for it. They were quite sensitive to the idea that, like, I think they thought that they needed to do that in order to, increase their sort of electoral chances in the future. They were stopped dead in their tracks by this growing, whatever you want to call it, conservative types of people. And they all, there was all these type of themes that went in there, and guns, the NRA, like you said, they basically created this tradition that, that with the help of the Supreme Court in 2008, made this point the other day, some of the ding dongs on Twitter don't seem to understand that if you say guns weren't illegal 50 years ago, my dad had to carry a permit to carry a gun. That's the point. That's exactly the point. 50 years ago, there was no such thing as, like, you need to have an unencumbered right to a gun. Your gun rights can be cumbered, essentially, whether it's you leave it outside a Dodge or, you got to have a permit, or There was an assault weapon ban for 10 years that was successful, at least in cutting down on the number of deaths from assault weapons. And so, you know, they are now, this is like a bedrock tradition. I mean, and Obama, you know, he got that idea. They cling to their guns and whatnot. He didn't really do much about it. Didn't know how to address it. Didn't realize that, you know, soon the tail was going to be wagging the dog. And that's exactly what Kramer was saying. It's like, this is out of our hands now. We, you know, we created Frankenstein, and now, you know, I'm not going to go tell Frankenstein he's got to sit in the corner. Frankenstein's monster, you know, is going to do what he's going to do. You cited a great piece by Sarah Binder about, you know, what's going to happen, you know, over the next like 3 or 4 weeks, and the failure in many respects of, like I say, I don't know how much there is to be done, but the Democratic leadership in pursuing this now, as opposed to when it's going to dissipate.
Well, this is a long story with the Democrats. And, you know, I feel bad I always come on here and, you know, I just rag on the Democrats. But, you know, hey, if the shoe fits, you got to, you know, you can't ignore the reality here. And when it comes to guns, the Democrats have been truly awful over the years. Now, I'm going to go back a little bit. In my piece today for Salon, I wrote about, you know, after the Columbine school shooting, which was kind of the first of the modern school shooting. You know, I mean, how awful to think about. But that was almost a quarter of a century ago now. Yep. It was 1999 when it happened. They had this similar situation to what they have in Houston, in Texas today, where the NRA was meeting just days afterwards. And they were meeting in Denver that year. This year it's Houston. Denver, Littleton, where Columbine took place, is a suburb of Denver. The Denver mayor begged them to cancel it, offered to pay their expenses and everything. And they refused. And in fact, last year there was revealed a phone conversation. Somebody had recorded the as part of this whole scandal within the NRA, obviously. Someone released to Tim Mack, the NPR reporter, that this recording of a phone call between all these leaders of the NRA after Columbine. And they were discussing whether or not to cancel it. And their reaction was, you know, we can't. It would be admitting that we're weak, that we're cutting and running. We can't do that. They said, you know, the only problem, and this is kind of hilarious, was that if they, is that they're afraid that maybe some of the establishment people wouldn't come to the convention, and only, as they put it, the hillbillies, fruitcakes, and nuts would show up, and that would kind of look bad, which I think is kind of funny. And they considered doing a victims fund, but decided against it because they said that would be twisted to make it sound like they were making an apology. So what they ended up doing was saying, no, they were very, very resistant. They said, absolutely not. We're going to have our meeting. Charlton Heston showed up as he was going to. They did cancel the gun show when it turned out that the two shooters in Columbine had gotten their guns at gun shows. But other than that, they refused to compromise. And the next year, Charlton Heston gave them what I think is the most famous pro-gun, you know, culture, one of the most famous culture war speeches in American history. It was my cold dead hands speech, right? Where he got up and said, you'll pry my gun out of my cold dead hands. And it's a very famous speech. If you look it up on YouTube, you can find it. I mean, it's horrifying. But in that speech, He you know, talks about the culture war almost in words they could be using today on Fox News. It's not like anything's changed or that this is some new cancel culture is some new thing. He was talking about it back then. This was in 2000. And at the end of his speech, he talked specifically about Hillary Clinton, and they all booed her, of course, and about Al Gore being a big threat. He was running, you know, in the 2000 election. Well, that year that, you know, we all know what happened in 2000, it was a very, very close election. The Republicans managed to pull it out with some dubious tactics in Florida and in the Supreme Court, but they won. And the Democrats immediately blamed it on guns and said it was completely because of Al Gore's stance on the assault weapons ban and they had to get rid of that, dump it completely out of the platform. They were losing all over the South. And it had to do with guns. And so forget it. And from throughout the 2000s, I don't know if people recognize this, all the way up until probably until Newtown, I think maybe it was Sandy Hook that really did sort of at least turn it around for the Democrats, if not for anybody else. they just were basically running as fast as they could from the gun issue, trying, you know, abortion too, by the way, but that's subject for another day. But guns, they were running from like crazy. I mean, these were the kinds of dynamics that were sort of fueled things like the Netroots and Majority Report and things like that was this kind of, what are you people doing? You know, I mean, this is crazy. You're just kind of completely giving up on your values and the things that people care about, and people are dying as a result. And that really was, that displayed a weakness, and it gave these Republicans an opening. I mean, they really, really were feeling their oats, and they have not stopped since. And now Democrats are playing catch up, and it's kind of too late now that it's been inculcated as one of the primary right-wing identities in America, this gun owning, you know, liberty thing that they've got going.
This whole dynamic that you're describing, the complete evacuation, if you will, of Democrats from the playing field on these issues. On abortion, it was the case. On the question, I think, frankly, on immigration, it was the case.
Yeah.
It was the case on guns. I mean, they're running from these as if they're – and they're still – this particular set of Democratic leaders still has this attitude that – we should not engage in these fights. And the point is, it does not go away. It metastasizes and becomes, at one point, hits a critical mass where there is no going back on that gunsling. And the fact of the matter is that the dynamic is this, and Binder wrote it in that piece. There are more people who want gun control. And it ranges the gamut as to what constitutes gun control. But there are more people who want gun control, want the assault weapon ban, let's just say it that way, than not. I mean, significantly more. But the people who are the gun nuts, that's their primary voting reason why they vote. And so the density and the intensity of those voters essentially outmaneuvers and outpowers a much greater size of voter who don't necessarily vote on that one single issue. And that dynamic exists because on one side of this battle, you had the NRA and the Republican Party creating these zealots. And on the other side, you just had people walking away and did not engage in this fight. And we see it, you know, we're seeing it in the context also, and I don't want to turn from the main issue here, which is, of course, these guns are killing people, but the stuff with the cops, like, there is another narrative here that the Democrats have been running away from for the past 2 years as a way of blaming their losses on it, which, again, it was not. And I, you know, I've not necessarily a fan of the lack of nuance of the three words defund the police, but who cares? That's not relevant, because these things can be turned it. You know, I also was not a fan of, like, how are they going to turn CRT into a boogeyman? Nobody knows what it is. Well, you know, if you exert enough effort from enough places, you can make, you know, a series of words mean something, you know, and the idea that you've had this town where 40% of their budget has been dedicated for God knows how many years to a police force, and perhaps the single most important moment, test of everything that you've learned in there. Like, I'm looking at these images and these videos of the cops dealing with the parents out front. And the thing that really struck me too is, like, look at the effing gear that they have on.
I know.
These guys are if these guys were military in the middle of a war zone, I would be like, wow. They are really decked out. These guys have every single possible imaginable set of gear. They're wearing it, and they're just doing – they're not even doing crowd control. You know what I mean? Like, and they're wearing all this gear. They've got, you know, guns with scopes. They've got, like, 14 different types of Kevlar protective gear. They've got, like, you know, they've got everything imaginable. Looks like you're looking like in an Avengers movie or something. And yet they're not doing anything because there are limits on what the police could do. If the Democratic Party had embraced, if not the slogan, the concept of police. We are spending too much money on policing. We are getting diminished returns from it. We could be doing a lot more for communities with that money than spending 40% of a town's budget on the cops. If that narrative had been there, it would have been doing double duty here. It would have been saying, A, the whole concept of good guys with the guns, those cops didn't go in there because they didn't want to die. And they were afraid of dying because this kid had a couple of semi-automatic or semi-assault weapons or whatever it was, enough of firepower that these cops were afraid, despite the fact that they were like, you know, like robocops, essentially. And yet there is no existing narrative. It is like if the Democrats can't feel that they can win anything in that moment, like it's low-hanging fruit, they build nothing. They do nothing for the future. There is nothing going on. And then to go and take 10 days off, you know, it's like, you know, Chuck Schumer doesn't want to have it. He wants to give time for negotiations. Bullshit. Yeah.
No.
Bullshit. They wanted to take their vacation. What's going on here.
I want to like be clear about that too. That's enraging. The idea that like the Senate just leaves, they want to take their vacation too. But he did this with Build Back Better as well. There should have been urgency, and not to go too off, you know, topic, but there should have been urgency to act then after COVID relief passed. But he was like, "Oh, we're going to let Biden said we're going to bring Republicans into this process as well." But frankly, Schumer's like, one, they want to go on vacation. Two, he doesn't have optimism that anything's going to pass, but he thinks the best time it would pass, the most opportune opportunity, is now, when you have the urgency and it's the rawness of the moment, as opposed to whipping votes and then the emotion of it in the country just completely dies down. This was the time to do something and hold a vote.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And the emotion dies down, by the way, because you see nothing happening. I mean, you know, this is a real sort of, you know, it's a chicken or the egg thing here. You know, you watch, you're going, okay, something's going to happen. And in other countries, it does. After what happened in Christchurch in New Zealand, they just immediately went and passed a law banning semi-automatic weapons. They didn't wait. I mean, this happened up in Canada. The same thing happened when they had the mass shooting last year. They went out and they just put in a bunch of new regulations and laws. And Canada's a gun country. They all have guns up there, but they managed to do that. But we don't do it because first of all, the Republicans, of course, stonewall. They have no, I mean, this idea that Chris Murphy is somehow going to get the Republicans together this one time, John Cornyn from Texas, sure, that'll happen. They're going to get together and do some real gun reform this time, because this time is different. Well, I've heard this. Yesterday I went through, I was preparing to write something about it, and I went through and read commentary after, you know, virtually every shooting for the last 10 years. They say it every time, particularly when kids are involved, school shootings. This time feels different. This time is different. It feels different. Everybody's really upset this time. This is going to happen. And so they use that. And Chuck Schumer says, you know, Chris Murphy says, hey, you know, Chuck, this time feels different. I think I can get it done. Chuck says, okay, great. Everybody wants to go on vacation.
Right.
They let it go. But they're just trying to run out the clock here until people start to, you know, the news cycle changes. You know how it works. I mean, we've been through it so many times. This is why I get, you know, cynical about the whole thing, because I'm just watching it happen again and again and again. And like in this situation down in Texas, we have this new thing where the cops really seem to have performed very badly. At the very least, something went wrong, which I think we all saw when we watched. First of all, the fact that they didn't do the usual pattern, that was a tip off to me. I'm going, where's the news conference? Where are the cops and the FBI out here, you know, standing out there in front of the press, giving us a rundown on what happened? And instead, you know, they just had the politicians come in and do a crocodile tears tableau for everybody up there, like they're at the Last Supper. You know, with sort of talking about mental health and doing all this. And I'm going, no, wait a minute. We just want to know what happened. What went on there that day? What's the story? What do you know? I mean, that's the pattern, and that's what the news media wanted. That's what we all wanted. They weren't really doing that. It was very vague and kind of strange. So we knew there was something wrong. And it's obviously still happening where they are obfuscating, something happened with the police there. And it's just as you said, Sam, this idea that they had this massive amount of firepower and they had several agencies. It wasn't just the small town police force that was there. They had the Border Patrol. They had Customs and Border Protection. They had U.S. Marshals. They had everything there on the scene. And yet this horror happened. So, you know, that you would think that that would refute once and for all the good guy with a gun theory. It, you know, didn't stop them at all. I mean, this is one of the things that the right does. They just keep going. They don't let, you know, facts get in the way. They just keep going. And the Democrats, on the other hand, the minute that, you know, some little thing happens that makes them, you know, kind of worry that their stance has cost them some votes in a swing district somewhere, they run for the hills. And this has ended up with these ideas on things like on these culture war ideas, these deep, deep, serious culture war ideas, which are really driving our politics. I don't believe it even has anything to do with taxes anymore. Honestly, I think this culture war is what's basically the fundamental issue in our culture and our politics. They have been allowed over the course of, you know, 20 or 30 years to just drive home their culture war ideas with very little opposition, or at the very least, the opposition is sporadic and fitful and inconsistent. So there's no countervailing force out there that is sort of, you know, fighting. It's like they're having these little, Democrats have these little skirmishes, and then, you know, oh, let's negotiate. And then they, oh, well, I guess that didn't work out. And then they go where the Republicans are just, they're like, you know, they're Sherman, you know, running through the South with their culture war. And I mean, this, it's killing people. We just saw it happen with the pandemic, with the rights, you know, aversion to masks and vaccines, and just absolutely being, you know, completely hostile to the kind of public health mitigation that was there and available for people to use in order to save lives, refused to do it. Because they are, you know, they are just on a sort of a nihilist collision course with modernity, and they're not going to let anything stop them. And here we have, you know, now we're having, you know, mass shootings, and have had for years now. We get these clusters of them where they all come up. There's, you know, and there'll be something horrific like a school shooting where dozens of children are injured and killed. And they just keep going. And the Democrats keep saying, well, gee, maybe this time people will wake up. That seems to be the strategy. As far as I can tell, strategy is, well, gee, maybe if it gets really bad, then people will wake up and they'll vote these people out of office, and then we can change things. It's just, you know, sit and wait. And I see no evidence that that's happening. I mean, what's happening instead is that we're all being completely depressed, and you know, a lot of people are checking out and just going, you know, I just can't. And that, it's not working. Whatever the Democrats' strategy, to the extent there is one, is not working.
No, it's not working. And the way, I mean, I feel like the way that you can, you could analyze this, you know, they say, like, you know, turn the volume off on debates and you'll get a notion of like, you know, how people are receiving these debates, where you don't actually hear it. You just look at the body language. I mean, if you were to turn off the volume and be able to represent the fight between these gun nuts and really the Republicans in this instance, and the Democrats, and we can put it the right and left if you on some level, if you want, but one is sitting there, you know, acting as if they are in the right and they are correct, and the other is just basically cowering on some level and not pulling out all the stops. And I understand that, like, you know, the limitations of these things here, but you could be, there is just too much fear on the Democratic side to do these things. And I don't believe that there's like that they secretly have an investment in the sales of guns. I think they're just too cowardly to address the issue in any meaningful way. And, you know, so you allow this space for, you know, Republicans to be like, it's all going to be about the one door. We just need to have every school just have one entrance. And that's going to be.
They shouldn't have windows. How about just bars? Bars and, you know, and every.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Like a prison. And yeah. they will push this for, you know, for a couple of weeks. And like you say, it'll die down and maybe there'll be another copycat shooting, but it'll only be like five kids and then there won't be enough. And then, you know, it's incredibly demoralizing. And they're just, you know, again, it is so reminiscent of what we've been saying over and over again on a whole host of issues. And look, again, the fact is that the vast majority of people who believe that there should be some type of gun control, it is not going to be their most important issue to vote on.
Why is that? Like what are they voting on? I mean, this is a question. Well, I mean, are they voting hasn't happened on to me. Taxes?
It hasn't happened to me, right? I would be fine with gun control, but like, it's hard when these massacres happen to other people and people experience a visceral emotion in the moment. But it doesn't change their voting patterns. I mean, you know, they're going to vote on identity first, and
identity. That takes a back seat. I have a 10-year-old child, a 9-year-old child. I mean, they have lockdown drills, and when I go to vote, you know, the vast majority of people I have the opportunity to vote for are for some measure of gun control. But if I'm given the choice between, I don't know, voting for, I'm just trying to like, you know, if I'm given the choice between voting for Bernie Sanders with his, you know, history of gun control, he's come around now. But let's just say even Bernie Sanders, when he was voting to, you know, when he was, when he was still more Vermont-y, I guess, okay, in a rural country versus, let's say, Terry McAuliffe. I don't know where Terry McAuliffe is on gun, but that profile, I'm probably going to vote for. No, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, and because all the other issues, Medicare for all, you know, regulations on banking, you know, on and on, are going to outweigh that. Plus, I also know that the marginal difference in having Terry McAuliffe's, you know, anti-gun stance. I don't even know if it is an anti-gun stance, but let's assume it is. I wish I could have made up just sort of different characters, but these are shorthand, so people forgive me on this. Get the idea of what I'm talking about here. The marginal difference of bringing in that really vehemently, pro-gun control, particularly in light of the Supreme Court, right? Because here's the fact of the matter is, even if they were to get votes across right now, they're not going to pass anything. Even the most like sort of anemic gun control measures are subject to being struck down by the Supreme Court. That's just a fact now. And so, you know, there is the problem is that the Democrats have done a very poor job in creating a narrative so that people understand how these things are connected. I mean, this is a function of the Supreme Court, at the very least. Like, New York City and New York State is about to have is about to lose the ability to say, like, regulate concealed carry, and that's going to go by the wayside. And you know, the Democrats, because they have disengaged from too many of these fights, they cannot make an overarching narrative as to, you know, what the value is in engaging in these fights, that what we saw with the Fifth Circuit ruling this week about, about essentially government's ability to function, what we're going to see with the EPA is tied into what we're going to see about this gun case in New York State and what we saw in 2008 with the Heller case. I mean, these things, there is a broader narrative to tell. But when you disengage from different parts of these stories, it becomes almost impossible to communicate to particularly to voters who are just like, you know, I come out for the presidential cycle. I mean, that's what we're facing here. And there just does not seem to be even the vaguest awareness amongst the 70 and 80 year olds that we have running this party, because not so much because of their age, but because of when, in which way their politics formed and when, I think.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that the Republicans do understand, and I mentioned Kevin Cramer, the North Dakota senator, who said, you know, hell, the voters will kick me out if I do it, you know. The Republicans do understand that they have a faction within their party. I mean, not every Republican is a gun nut. Not every Republican is, you know, I mean, look at the ads that Republicans do, right? I mean, they're all packing heat in their campaign ads now. Kay Ivey, the little old lady down in Mississippi, just did a gun ad where, you know, you never know what's in my purse. You know, it could be a Wesson 38 or whatever she says. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, it's nuts. And they're all out there with the AR-15s and blowing stuff up. I mean, this is what they do in their ads. And it's not because all of their voters are gun nuts, because they aren't. A lot of Republicans, I mean, they're like, you know, the people you're talking about. Yeah, well, whatever. I care about taxes, or I'm an abortion person, or I'm this or whatever. But this group of gun nuts that are within the Republican Party, and that's where they all are, they have kind of veto power. I mean, the way our system is set up, you have these factions within each coalition that have a tremendous amount of power, that if they don't vote or they vote in a primary and take somebody out who isn't properly doctrinaire on the issue that they care about, they will exert that power in primaries, and they will, you know, basically destroy a career if they have the power to do that. Well, the Democrats have factions too. And there are people who are against guns. There are people who are against abortion. Not everybody is, you know, just, I mean, they have intense factions too. The Democrats aren't scared of those people, though. They're not, they have not yet gotten it into our heads. And partially that is a matter of organizing, right? On the right, they have organized. The anti-abortion faction in the Republican Party is highly organized through churches, basically, and through religious groups and a bunch of grifters who make a lot of money off of it. Same thing with the gun story. Same thing with all these culture war issues. There are groups that are highly organized on the right that exert their power over the party. They don't hold back. They don't sit there and go, well, gee, you know, maybe I shouldn't be, you know, so vocal. I shouldn't be so uncivil. I should be more understanding. The Democrats don't have that. I mean, of course, there's a strong, you know, a very strong pro-abortion rights faction in the Democratic Party, obviously. There's a strong, you know, anti-gun, you know, or pro-gun safety, you know, faction in the Democratic Party. But they don't have that. They don't exert the same kind of power, and the Democrats aren't afraid of them. They just sit there. I mean, they've been slapped in the face over and over again. They go out of their way to slap these factions in the face and say, look, where are you going to go? I mean, that's basically right. What their argument is. What are you going to do? You know, if you don't vote for us, where are you going to vote for the other guy? It's a very different way of approaching this. And some of this is going to have to come down to the organizers, who are going to have to start exerting that power. And you're seeing it a little bit. I mean, I'm being unfair here, because the progressives have made some very serious inroads in recent years that were not there 10 or 15 years ago when we first started talking about this stuff. They really are a much more organized faction. But, you know, on these discrete culture war issues, and I'm just going to say it again, I honestly think that this is where, and I, you know, I hate to say it, but I think climate is a culture war issue too. Maybe science, you know, just in general, but climate specifically is a culture war issue that has to be fought, and the Democrats cannot shy away from this. And it's going to take these organized groups within the Democratic coalition that are going to have to push them a lot harder. They're going to have to push Democrats a lot harder on this stuff. That is where it's going to be. And it's going to be within the party itself, because that war is going to happen, whether we like it or not. That culture war, which, you know, Charlton Heston was talking about 25 years ago, for God's sakes, and they're still talking about it on Fox News every day. That war is happening, and they're winning, and they're winning big. And look, just the Supreme Court is the perfect result of it. That battle, we lost it, and it's going to be hell retaking that, you know, that hill, if you want to extend the stupid metaphor. But I mean, you know, this, getting that back and getting some balance back into American politics is going to be hugely difficult. And it won't happen if you're just waiting for Chris Murphy to make a deal on some, you know, minor trivial thing on gun rights with John Cornyn, that's never going to happen. That is just not going to be the way that the war is won. Well, it isn't. I mean, that'll be a win for them, actually, if you do that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, let me just add one thing, and then, sure. And then Emma, go ahead. They are 30 years ahead of us on this.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Buchanan, right? In the, what was it, the 92 the convention, Republican convention, announcing, you know, we're in a culture war. I mean, he was saying it explicitly at that time. So they they still had probably 10, 15 years prior to that, frankly, where they had been waging it. And it just 15 years later, he's got an important speaking slot at the Republican National Convention. And that was 30 years ago. And so that's the thing. It's it has been, we're behind on this, in a big, big way. And so people have to both like keep that in mind, 'cause you were talking about the advances that we have made with progressive organizing. And I think that's true, but it also, people should not lose hope in regards to how little has been done, because it's not been enough time. Frankly, where people have been actively engaging this, but go ahead, Emma. What we got some breaking news? Is that what it is?
Well, I mean, it's kind of the natural culmination of. I want to get your take on this, Heather, because Matt just sent this to us. This is a tweet from Eric Wasson, a Bloomberg reporter. Basically, the drip, drip, drip of what's coming out about these cops malpractice in Texas. It's astounding to me, and it seems like more information is going to come. So Eric Wasson tweets out that police in Uvalde admit they mistakenly thought there were no more children alive in the classroom to explain why they waited outside. 911 calls from kids show differently. And I also this was from the Wall Street Journal piece on this, which has a ton of like horrific details in it. From the Wall Street Journal piece. A mom of two children at Uvalde was put in handcuffs after urging police and law enforcement to enter the school. Once freed from her cuffs, she jumped the school fence, ran inside, and sprinted out with her kids because they were really blocking the parents from going in. I mean, but they were not doing anything themselves, and the police were doing nothing, said Angeli Rose Gomez, who, after learning about the shooting, drove 40 miles where her children were in second and third grade, and she basically jumped the fence and went in. But that initial breaking news from Eric Wasson, that they have no choice but to admit, essentially, that, no, there were kids alive. There was a girl who smeared her friend's blood on herself and pretended to be dead and was calling 911, and she's
911.
Yeah, and so they just stood out there like talking about the Democrats' weakness. If there's not an immediate federal investigation into this,
absolutely.
I mean, they're like Merrick Garland. Does he have a? Is he a real person? Is he a? Is he a hologram? Is he a mirage? Like, where is the federal government on an investigation into this right now? Right now, I'm curious about your take, Heather.
Well, let me just add this too. So post this one, Matt. I just put that to Bradley. I just put it. This is from
Amna Nawaz is her name.
Amna Nawaz, she's I guess with PBS, chief correspondent for PBS. I guess the timeline offered by the Texas officials right now is gutting. There were 19 police officers in the hallway who made the decision not to break into the room at the same time children inside were alive and calling 911. One begged, please send police now. This is, they were afraid of entering into that one door because that's where, you know, you can imagine those 19 guys looking around going like, I'm not going to be first. Who's going to be first? I mean, I don't understand how it's just,
and it's not as if there wasn't training. I mean, apparently these, you know, there have been tons of training drills among cops in the schools. They had the local SWAT team come in and do a full training round in that school. And the idea that they didn't understand the reality there, which is that after Columbine, because it took that Columbine took hours. They were in there shooting for hours, and the cops did what people often do, what cops are trained to do in a normal hostage situation, which is they established a perimeter around the school, and then they waited for the tactical teams to come get a lay of the land and, you know, do it. And it ended up killing a whole lot of kids because they waited so long. So the tactics that were adopted after that by cops were that you go in as quickly as possible. You do not wait. You go in, even if you've only got two or three people, you go in there and you have to confront the shooter, because if you don't, more kids are going to die. And the idea being that, look, we don't let kids die. We just don't let that happen. Apparently they did in this case. The 19 cops in the hallway. And by the way, I guess they had to get a key to open up the door, which nobody thought of in the first hour that they were there. I guess they made the assumption that all the kids were dead, which is like the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life.
There were 911 calls.
There were 911 calls. How would even if there weren't?
It's a lie. They're lying. How could they not?
Of course they're lying.
They can't break down the door. Like, they need a key.
Did they go around to the window? Did they do, anything? I mean, and of course, you know, not that I don't understand. It is very, very scary to confront somebody with two AR-15s. That's why they shouldn't have AR-15s in our society.
Exactly.
Because they're very,
exactly.
very
they
scary.
They scare the cops, even.
Of it course proves they do. It. Yeah, the yes. cops. I mean, look, I was saying earlier in the show that Republicans are going to immediately say, cops need to now all have AR-15s. So they are all, every cop right. in the country. I guarantee it. But these cops, I don't know what guns they had, but as Sam was saying, they certainly were decked out in a lot of gear.
They had plenty of firepower. I mean, they had plenty of firepower. But yeah, facing an AR-15 is a problem. It's like Donald Trump used to say, you know, well, there should have been more bullets going the other way. Like, you know, having bullets flying all over the place is the answer to things. That's what they always say. Cops know better, because they actually are, you know, confronted with flying bullets, and they were out there going, you know, I'm afraid. On the other hand, I'm sorry, you know, we have been forced in our society, you know, they absolutely, the cops have been obviously withholding their, you know, their involvement in a lot of urban situations recently where, you know, crime rates are roaring. And a lot of people, I live in one of those places, you do too, where, you know, you're wondering, why is this crime rate going up the way that it is? Part of it is that, you know, there are cops who are just not engaging. They're not engaging in dealing with crime. And that's because they don't like the idea that somebody said defund the police once.
Right.
And they're mad that they're under some kind of pressure coming from politicians to reform their policing tactics. So there's a whole lot that we're being forced to in this society. We're not allowed to really criticize the police. They get very upset. The right goes crazy. We have to worship the police. They're, you know, you do whatever a cop tells you. Don't ever say anything to a cop, all this stuff. Yet at the same time, you know, many of the police. Now, I guess in Texas they did protest the new law that allows, you know, open carry with no permitting in Texas. The cops did not like that. But in a lot of cases, the cops, big fans of Donald Trump, all the major police organizations backed him, backed the NRA. You know, we're in a very confused situation with the police. And, you know, I'm not saying I blame them for being afraid to go in and confront the AR-15 using psychopath. But on the other hand, that is their job. And that is what, you know, they complain constantly that we are supposed, you know, they have a very dangerous job. They have to be held to no standards. They have to have all this qualified immunity because, you know, it's very dangerous and they have to do this. They're confronting killers. Well, here we're in a situation where they didn't do that job. They just didn't do it. And you know, I would love to know why. I mean, obviously, Emma, you're absolutely right about the feds. I agree with you. There should be a statement coming out today from the head of the FBI and Merrick Garland and every other, you know, the ATF and whoever else. CPB, they were there, by the way. The Border Patrol was there. So they have to, you know, somebody's got to be looking at them too. And there has to be, you know, a sense that, look, this is one situation where we're not going to do some reflexive defense of the poor policeman because 19 kids were killed. And God knows, you know, we don't even know about the horrific injuries that for the 17 others that were wounded.
And you know, it's impossible to speculate, but you get the sense that they called in the CPB because they were afraid.
Yeah.
And like it's just, there has to be this pressure applied by the federal government on what the cops did, because you can't get to, you need them to come out and admit we're afraid.
Yeah.
Because it's so that you can start to deal with the reality of what it means to allow people to walk around with these weapons. And, you know, this is...
These are weapons of war that 18-year-old kids are able to purchase on the internet. It's literally insane. Yeah. Literally insane that you can go and buy weapons of war when you turn 18 years old and go on the internet and buy them. On credit, apparently. I guess he even got credit to I mean, I don't know how that happened. But, I mean, this is just, it's complete. It's like the guy from Sky News yesterday who confronted Ted Cruz. You know, the look on his face is just like, what is going on here? What are you, right. What is with you people? You know, this is just crazy. And, you know, Ted Cruz starts talking about, you know, how this is the greatest country in the world and people want to come here.
Safest too. He says safest. Yeah. Insanity.
And everybody wants to come here. And I'm going, yeah, and you don't want to let them either.
Right,
you know,
right, exactly.
What the hell? You know, so, I mean, it's very confused, but that's really appalling. I cannot believe that they actually are saying that, you know, well, we thought they were all dead, so we figured why not wait a while. I mean, what the hell? That's well, there's going to be some very, very serious lawsuits. I have absolutely no doubt.
Talk about police departments that need to be dissolved and rebuilt.
Yeah. I mean that's really what needs to happen. And if you saw the mayor of that town, I mean, it seems so weird to me. The town is 90% Latino, I think. And the mayor, it's, you know, he's like Boss Hogg from Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's out there, you know, screaming at Beto O'Rourke and, you know, calling him names and all this stuff. So the politics in that town and everything else, I mean, that's just one little town. I mean, you got to go across, you know, a good part of the country to try and dismantle all that. But you can imagine seeing that guy, just how corrupt the whole situation really is down there.
Heather Parton, Digby, I wish it was under better circumstances, but always a pleasure to talk to you about this stuff, or at least always enlightening, and really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, and have a restful Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, thank you. You too. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Matthew Film Guy. And we should just say, you know, like, we were all wondering, like, should we have, not, this is not a function of you, Matthew, but should we have a segment that is, you know, not as as sort of serious in the moment? And I think on some level we need a little bit of a break from this. I mean, just sort of horrible. I mean, I imagine a lot of people have been just sort of like, compelled by this story and, 24/7 it, you know, and, so a little bit of break. And with that spirit, Matthew Film Guy, your theme song.
We didn't know.
We
didn't do Digby, so we weren't sure if we wanted to do themes, but we'll do it.
All right. And no theme song. Oh, there we go. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew,
Film Guy. Hello, Sam. Hello, Emma. Thanks for having me.
Hello, Matthew.
There's Matthew, Film Guy. Now, Matthew, your backdrop is probably a little confusing to people who watch the show on a regular basis. It is very
busy.
Well, in some way, very different than the normal, but in some ways also very similar to normal. Why might that be?
That's so dense. That like so much a density in the imagery there, right?
Yes,
like lots.
Yes.
Isn't that what people used to say about the Star Wars prequels?
Yeah. Well, it costs. It's really hard to compress that for a video because there's so much information behind it.
Yeah.
Actually, Mary's going to love that you said that because she likes to draw the aesthetic comparisons between my mother and myself. I like to pack things in. But yes, I'm at my mother's in Boca Raton, Florida. We're on a little vacation. As I may have mentioned, we're about to go celebrate her 70th birthday at Disney World.
Fun.
But you know, if I can touch on how you introduced the segment for a second, you know, I've actually often wanted this segment to be less than more than just sort of trivial entertainment based, you know, at the risk of being pretentious, which is, you know, sort of my core brand proposition. I think that, you know, film and art actually do have something to say and used to have the ability to address issues that I think are antecedents to our cultural problems and our societal and political problems. It's just that in late stage capitalism, we don't get any even inkling of that in our popular culture. We really do have to dig and, you know, search and find and sometimes look overseas for the kind of artists still working on films that may actually have the opportunity to disrupt the status quo, whether that's a political status quo, but more often an emotional and internal and a psychological status quo of the audience because of all the commercial pressures. So, you know, at the risk of being too grandiose, I actually think that properly focused, a film segment can address the kind of things that result in what we saw this week from top to bottom, you know, a technological culture that dehumanizes people, even a sort of what you might call a left liberal kind of filmmaking tends to sort of mechanize and atomize and abstract the information that it gives you. And it actually has a fundamental, I think, atrophying effect on our imaginations, on our ability to actually conceive of a new world. You know, the sign in the marches say, another world is possible. I think the best films are actually showing that another world is possible on a very, very, you know, existential level. So I don't think that there's a dichotomy or a sort of irony of having a movie segment on such a somber day. And it is a horrible, tragic, somber day. But, you know, I think it's an opportunity for us to reflect. You know, listen, I always say I consume just as much cultural garbage as the next good film guy. But there has to be a place made for us to challenge ourselves to actually question our own assumptions, not just that of our political enemies and so on, and to see how we all play a role in the society that we've created. So, you know, there are the rare films that I think are able to do that, but nobody wants to see those. You just don't want to go look and see, oh, please destabilize me. I mean, I do, but I'm a masochist, but I often don't, too. So this is, I don't know how to better sell this project because most people don't want to hear it. But at a certain point, I think it becomes more and more clear that we are culturally and emotionally atrophied in that we keep going down this same road. And it's like I always like to quote Ezra Pound, who said about literature, but I think it's all art. It's the news that stays news because it's discussing what we are as human beings and how these things can come about. It's not just the other that is responsible.
Well, Matthew, I was looking forward to just more, you know, making fun of the stuff behind you.
I also went and saw Doctor Strange. I don't know.
Oh, Doctor Strange 2.
Multiverse of Madness.
What did you think about it?
I did not watch it. I did not see that.
I enjoyed it. I was able to clear up my mind, relax, and float downstream. Yeah, go on, Sam.
No, I think, I mean, obviously.
Oh, look at that.
And that's a good point. It's a tough sell. But also, I think, you know, there's no doubt that if we all consumed a better brand of culture, we would be, our brains would be a little bit more nimble in dealing with these things. And if we had already wrestled with a lot of these questions,
I think it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg situation, but I think we have to acknowledge that the kinds of culture that we do have ready access to, and today we live in a golden era of all these options, they're all always going to be focused through that sort of corporatizing, mechanizing, technocratic lens. So it's a really, Sisyphean task to try to, like, you know, get access to something that even attempts to be different.
Yeah, I will say this. During the time I had COVID, I started to rewatch Mad Men, which is, you know, I had seen it at first run, but it was different back then. They didn't dump everything at one time. It was over the course of like, I think 4 years, maybe 5, 6. I don't know. There's like 7 seasons. Watching it all together, I've watched all 7 seasons over the course of the past like 6-7 weeks.
Oh, you finished, Sam?
I finished, and the themes in there incredibly intense and dense, and stuff that you could really chew on for an extended period of time. Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what we're dealing with at the moment, but what we're talking about at the moment and reacting to in terms of the shooting, but. The ability of a show or a movie or culture or book to get you thinking about human dynamics and issues like this is, I think, you know, largely lost. I mean, it'll be completely gone, I would say, probably in about 6 to 8 months.
I mean, it's been gone. That's why, like, honestly, you got to scrape the dark corners of the world and of the internet. And luckily I live in New York City, where at least there's still some cultural institutions that are trying to scrape out a living, making themselves dedicated to these things. But, you know, criticize anybody's taste in movies, because like I said, I watch all the TV and movies. 90% of my content is of this other kind. But, you know, even a show like Mad Men, which is, you know, corporately funded and distributed and is a big hit, it's even that is sort of part of the problem as far as I see, because it takes these themes, which I actually think there are relevant themes, the way advertising has sold us a vision of life and taken us away from each other by replacing it with the fun of buying things and this image of ourselves that, you know, consumerism can ennoble, but it's still giving you ideas. You're still never at the end of one of those episodes really going to go like, oh my God, what the hell was that? Like, you know, it's not disrupting your status quo in any way. It's giving you a kind of an idea.
I don't agree.
You gotta go back and watch Mad Men. I mean, that whole, when you watch it like that, you realize, I mean, the advertising stuff, sure, it takes place, but, really, that is much more about relationships, about relationships.
It's about trauma. It's about, I mean, it's about sexual trauma,
point is, and I'll just, full disclosure, I haven't seen that many episodes of Mad Men per se, but I've watched other prestige dramas. And the point is, it's about those things, right? And the aboutness is something, and this is maybe, again, an esoteric point, but the aboutness is not the same thing as being a direct disruption of your own life. And that is something that I've, you know, sitting in a theater being like, I don't even want to watch this. I can't tolerate this. This is something I want
Matthew,
to enjoy.
Mad Men is probably and I know you're the expert, but I think it's the greatest show I've ever seen in my life. Like I'm done saying that.
But I would say, you know, more specifically, the Mad Men does actually, you watch it compressed like I did, I can tell you that I was like, I don't want to watch this. I think one of the best shows that I have ever seen that I really was not particularly enjoying. I mean, it was.
Well, that is the greatest.
But Sam, when did you stop enjoying it? Because like, I feel like the first five seasons are pretty enjoyable, but when Don's like darkness comes home to roost and his affairs become seedier and like his second marriage is a sham. Sorry for everybody who, but
spoiler alert.
I mean, like that, that I think is just where you're like, where he hits rock bottom. That's when it becomes hard to watch, but it's earned because it had to fall apart for him given the fact that he's not dealt with his trauma in any meaningful way and he's pushed it off onto other people and hurt so many.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know at what point it became sort of painful. But it's a brutal show that that I think in many respects is not necessarily about ideas, but the way that emotions play and I think you need to watch. But I get what you're talking about. This is a Carney-esque. And we're talking about Ray Carney, who is the maybe not famed enough scholar of Cassavetes films. And the
who also put us together. That is,
yes,
to say that full disclosure.
Yes, he connected us. And it is, and he would say, you know, at least in the context of Cassavetes, there is something you're experiencing, like the emotional experience that you're having. It is the watching human beings be human, as opposed to trying to address a specific idea, or theme even on some level, is really what the best cinema does. And within the constructs, within the constraints of a TV show, like you say, you know, it's got to have whatever, four acts and commercial breaks, and there's got to be a certain amount of suspense, a certain plot. I have to say that Mad Men, not the most enjoyable. I loved watching Battlestar Galactica again, and Sopranos, and this one was painful. There's a lot
of high praise.
Yeah, yeah, it really is worthwhile.
Can I ask a quick question? Because I'm not really that familiar with Cassavetes and like that I've heard you guys talk about it. But is that like how his work is characterized as deep character, not to overuse that, but character studies and emotional studies and some about people, you know, having internal battles and the subtlety of that? Is that?
Yeah, well, I don't actually think it's even the internal battles per se. But yeah, that's a pretty fair sort of, boiled down description how popular he's understood. But you know, look, there's this guy Ray Carney. He wrote tomes and tomes on the sort of energies that his films tried to capture that most films couldn't actually even address. But it's not necessarily even about internal states. It's often about, he wanted to make a film that made you have an actual experience while watching it. So you weren't like reading something and going, I guess I understand. This is what he's saying. You were going through a sort of series of disruptions, dislocations, confusions, connections, disconnections. And it was almost like a kind of a jazz-like emotional experience. And that was why he often was very reviled. I mean, obviously he has his huge reputation and the people who love him, but mm-hmm. he was willing to alienate an audience. He was willing to make them not understand everything at every moment, what's happening, what's going on with this person, what's going on with that person. And, take these kind of emotional risks of being unlikable, some of the characters, or literally unbelievable, right? Like a little bit of like, why did he do that? I can't understand that. I'm not right. Given a sort of, so it's the experience and the kind of dedication to, you know, Carney calls it the pragmatic aesthetic over the visionary aesthetic, where most movies give you the ability to go into their minds and know, oh, she wants this and he wants that, and they're in conflict. You're more on the surface with a Cassavetes movie, or also I would say like a John Jost movie, or even someone in the international cinema like Bresson or Tarkovsky. They're all working in their own sort of frequency, but they all sort of are connected by this ability to try to give you an actual experience and not necessarily handhold you all the way through it with ideas or sort of clarity. And it doesn't sound great, but when you actually give over to it, it's incredible because you sort of, you know, Carney's words are you get new eyes and ears. You're not given an idea. You're given an ability to perceive something. And it expands your own capacity that you can actually take back with you into life, as opposed to just like, oh, that was interesting. I'll file that away and never think of it again.
Yeah. My final point on this, like that makes sense to me. And I think that's some of the work the movies or shows I connect with too. And what I like particularly about Mad Men is I feel that some of that in shows like Breaking Bad were reserved for more male characters. And, you know, whatever Skyler in that is portrayed as, she has complexity, but it's kind of a nag because she doesn't want her husband to be in the meth trade anymore. Like Mad Men's female characters, especially because it was written by a male creator, like through the roof in terms of complexity. And so you can like emotionally resonate with them even when Don is difficult to root for. But, you know.
Emma, I would say check out A Woman Under the Influence and see if it's like any other movie that you've ever seen.
That's A Woman Under the Influence?
A Woman Under the Influence. It's all on the Criterion Channel. All the Cassavetes stuff is there.
Okay.
But, you know, also, I would just say to people, I've been actually reading this book. It's not all Ray Carney who thinks this way. I don't know if you've heard of this. I forget where I've come across this one. But The Middle Mind by Curtis White, you know, he kind of widens out the conversation. It's even a little bit more in a political sort of vein. But he's talking about these same themes that, you know, our art and our culture are leading us in a certain path. And anything that, defers from that path is basically ignored or reviled. And it's led to, a cultural sort of critical mass that were, and he wrote this book, and I think in 2004. So it's actually, I think, even just gotten worse. And, you know, I try to put a little bit, right every week to keep that brain state open. But it's hard, you know, even for someone who's at least explicitly dedicated to doing this, it's difficult. They're not entertaining. They're not always, empowering. Sometimes they are just like, what the hell did I just watch for 2 hours?
Yeah.
But we got to, I don't know. It feels like we have to do something that's difficult in order to get a different result than what we're getting. At least that's how I live my life.
Yeah.
To the extent that I can. Then I go see Doctor Strange 2 and it all goes away.
And then it all goes away. well, so Matthew, with that in mind.
Doctor Strange 2.
There you go. Bingo. All right. Well, glad we
better
got that
than
result.
One. No, let me, in all honesty, let me give you one to actually take.
I watched Sky High last weekend. It was from 2005. It was still pretty good.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that one. Was it good?
No, it's
great.
Is that a kid's movie?
It was a movie for Saul.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's
a
high school for superheroes, Matthew.
Oh my God. I've always wanted to go to one of those.
Sorry.
In the sky.
Wow.
Oh, well, of course, because they can fly there.
They're like, are they trying to knock off Hogwarts, right? Like Harry Potter had come out by that time. So
is it not in the sky, Sam? The high school's not in the sky?
It is in the sky, but they can't fly. They have to take a flying bus. I don't think it's... Oh. I don't
Ooh.
Think...
Public transportation is still good.
I don't think it's... I don't even remember when exactly Harry Potter came out, but it wasn't
the
so
90s,
much,
but the books, yeah, and then the movie there, came
there
out.
Was, there was some
early
going on
2000s.
In 05, though. There was like, I think maybe the third or fourth one was maybe 05.
It could have, yeah. it could have been, you know, sort of like, but it really is not, not so much, not so okay. much, maybe a little bit, but not
it sounds,
much.
It sounds beneath me, Sam. I prefer to watch serious, teen cartoons like Young Justice. Okay. So.
Fair enough. But what do you have for a recommendation for us this week?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention my film class, online film appreciation class that I teach, where I try to bring these kinds of movies and enter into discussions that help us, even including me, understand what it is that we're looking at, why it's doing what it's doing, how to read the movie, how to understand its ideological and emotional messages, which is, I think, that's the lost art, really. So we try to see these kinds of movies, and they're always movies I haven't seen either. So I get to really come at it fresh and see just what it's like to wrestle with these kinds of movies. And we've seen a couple really good ones lately. One that I think is pretty good. I wouldn't say it's like the absolute tops of what the form can do, but it's a little bit also topical, and it's called Loveless. It's a Russian film, and I'm going to butcher the guy's name. His name is Andrei Zhnyazsev. You'll have to look it up because it's Russian and it's not my native tongue, But it's a little bit maybe almost too explicitly political in some ways, but it's about a divorcing couple whose young boy goes missing and the sort of trials and tribulations they go through to find him. But it's got a lot of extreme cultural critique about technology. And it's funny to see it in the Russian context. There's a lot of news reports going on in the background about Ukraine. This movie was made in, I think, 2017. So it's already in their cultural sort of zeitgeist. And all this stuff about phones and technology and atomization of our families and lives. I can't recommend it really any more highly, maybe by half a notch, Loveless. But then I just also want to throw in one that I didn't show in my class because it's a little too short. But there is a documentary filmmaker whose name is John Gianvito. Do you know him at all, Sam? No? John Gianvito? I just started getting into his stuff, and he made this movie called The Prophet Motive and The Whispering Wind. And it basically is an hour long, and all it consists of is these shots of nature and a lot of gravestone markers and the sort of historical markers, like on the roadsides and stuff like that. He seems to me sort of in the vein of another filmmaker I love named John Jost. Maybe you know who he is, Sam, but his movie, it's like a visual essay, you would say, but it's gripping because you're really being taken to all these different graves. You know, everyone from John Brown to Susan B. Anthony to Henry George, all these sort of maybe leftists and a lot of labor leaders, the sites of a lot of labor massacres. It's actually really affecting and really gripping. And it's about, you know, the memory that we have, the cultural memory that basically just evaporates. We get a little road sign once in a while, but seeing them all condensed, maybe almost like you watched Mad Men condensed, was actually very effective and I thought really moving and really a great film. His movies, I can't recommend them all. I haven't seen them all, but John Gianvito and Prophet Motive and The Whispering Winds. But I am able to recommend that people join my film class. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Langdon Boom and on Twitter at Langdon Boom and see where all the sign-up information is for that. We meet on Tuesdays, we see a film, and then we talk about it on Tuesdays. And I'd love to see you all there. Plenty of MR family are there already, so come join us.
And lastly, I think what I'd be remiss at this point, according to an IMer I just noticed too, was that Bob's Burgers movie is coming out this weekend.
Yeah.
I don't like animated movies.
I also don't like animation, broadly speaking. But
will I be lost if I haven't watched the show?
You know, that's a good question. I have not seen it. And I know is that I am in it for about 25 seconds.
I was watching the hockey playoffs last night, the Rangers in the playoffs, and it goes, brought to you by the Bob's Burgers movie. And I said, wow, I can't escape Sam.
You're like, I know a guy in that for 20 seconds.
Anywhere. I can't escape Sam anywhere. He's
like Shen Yun.
If it, you know, I have mixed feelings. If it does well, there's a slight chance that maybe Hugo reemerges in the coming years of the show. If it does, if it doesn't do well, then maybe the show, you know, whatever, the franchise begins to wind down and Hugo doesn't make a reappearance. Mm. But if it does well, it's also like an argument. We don't need Hugo in something.
Well, I think
with only 20 seconds. So I don't know. I don't know whether to root for it or not. But
people who go to it, you know, tweet out, say the Hugo 20 seconds were the best part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
If you don't go to it, just tweet that.
Hashtag Hugo spinoff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just see a shared Bob Burger cinematic universe coming, don't you? Hugo gets his own series, his own Netflix six-part series.
Yeah, no? I'm for it. I'm for all of it.
Maybe he health inspects other restaurants. What? Just throwing it out there.
Yeah, I got I'm not going to go into that, but I had.
Well, spoilers.
No, not spoilers.
Okay.
Matthew Film Guy, always, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Just what we needed, I think, on a day like today.
My pleasure, Sam. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Sam. Good to see you guys.
Thanks.
Take care.
All right, folks. That marks the end of the free show. We are going to head into the fun half of the program. I'm not sure we're going to take phone calls. We'll definitely read some IMs. Just a programming note, we will have no show on Monday. It's Memorial Day. We have, that is a tradition around here. We take Memorial Day off because people don't tend to listen to podcasts or watch stuff as much on Memorial Day. So that is what we're doing. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, free of commercials, you also get the fun half, which you can, of course, access if you're watching on video. Go to majority.fm, log in. The link will be at the top of the post, of the members' post for that day. Right, Bradley?
Yes. Yes, it'll be yes. There.
And you click on that, you can watch it there. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekien media universe?
Yeah, for patrons this weekend, I talked to Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent. He's a policy director there. We talked about this new terrorism legislation that appears stalled. And if it does constitute a Patriot Act 2.0, Chip is a little, thinks it's worth opposing, but thinks that might be a little bit exaggerated. But we talked about the overall general civil liberties landscape and also the disinformation board. So a lot of discussion that a lot of like civil liberties issues that Republicans are concerned about. But there's some things to actually be concerned about. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that conversation.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Keene.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go tell her.
Ooh, libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.